intentar no demorar más el inicio de esta sesión. Dentro de esta serie de encuentros con los que queremos acompañar las inauguraciones de las exposiciones, en este caso contamos con el privilegio de tener con nosotros al artista Hans Hacke. Ayer, en la inauguración, algunos de ustedes tuvieron la oportunidad de enfrentarse ya directamente con la obra. Y en esta sesión lo que pretendemos es propiciar un diálogo con la audiencia que muchas veces el formato exposición no permite. Hans nos sugirió que para establecer este diálogo contáramos con alguien como Walter Grascam, que es posiblemente quien mejor conoce su obra, alguien que lleva trabajando con Hans durante muchos años, que ha publicado en numerosas ocasiones también alrededor de la obra de Hans, y que van a detonar este diálogo que pretendemos que también se extienda también al resto de la audiencia. Que el arte no es autónomo es algo que seguramente todos sabemos. Sin embargo, el que un museo o que el arte pueda ser crítico es algo que posiblemente sea materia de debate. Esa criticidad del arte fue y ha sido y es la posición desde la cual se configura la obra de Hans Hacke. Desde el principio, desde sus obras de los años 50, consideró que el arte tenía la misión de hacer una crítica materialista del mundo que nos rodea, rompiendo todos los idealismos, todas las ensoñaciones, todas las mistificaciones. Sus obras reivindicaban desde unos parámetros materialistas y realistas esa posibilidad crítica que era desde el arte, pero también era sobre el propio arte. La obra de Hans Hacke, digamos, dio el sentido que hoy conocemos al término crítica institucional, y en esta obra que ha hecho específicamente para el Museo Reina Sofía, para Madrid, en el año 2012, Castillos en el aire, se establece un paralelismo entre esa crítica institucional, la crítica a la burbuja, a la burbuja idealista del arte, con la burbuja inmobiliaria, la burbuja financiera. Ambas burbujas habrían entrado en crisis, habrían explotado, y actualmente está, digamos, en el aire, digamos, la posibilidad de construir, digamos, una nueva realidad a partir de, digamos, de esa realización materialista de que tales fantasmagorías ya no existen. El diálogo se va a desarrollar en primer lugar por parte de Walter y de Hans, recorriendo de un modo entre cronológico y temático por toda la obra del artista, y en un momento dado se abrirá digamos, al público el debate para que no solo se interpele a ambos respecto a las obras que nos van a comentar aquí, sino también respecto al propio tema que constituye el leitmotiv de Castillos en el aire. Sin más, les doy la palabra, les agradezco muchísimo que estén aquí hoy con nosotros. Agradezco muchísimo a Hans la dedicación que ha tenido estos largos meses de investigación y de trabajo con el museo, que ha sido un maratón largo, que finalmente ha acabado también un sprint, montar una exposición como la que han podido contemplar o que pueden contemplar es un trabajo ímprobo, y también por la generosidad que han tenido con nosotros durante el día de hoy, donde han sido sometidos ambos a un examen inquisitorial por parte del Departamento de Actividades Públicas para generar un archivo que estará disponible en la web con digamos, sus testimonios. Hans Walter, tienes la palabra.
Thank you very much. Good evening to everybody. On behalf of my friend Hans Harte and me, although we were both born in Germany, we will do this talk in English, which is not our native language. Hans has more practice than I do because he lives in New York. I will do this talk in what I think is English. I hope you don't mind, and most of all, I hope you don't notice. Let me first start. Can we have the first image? It's on the computer, but not on the wall. Ah, okay, thank you very much. Let me start with an anecdote that I like to tell very often, but probably not to you. It's an anecdote that dates back 30 years. And it was a time when I was a young critic and I visited the Documenta archive in Kassel preparing a book on a magazine on the history of the Documenta, which was meant as a kind of a pictorial history of the Documenta. And I sifted through the photos that were stored in Kassel and I found a lot of them very interesting and useful. And among all these photographs that I found there, there was one photograph, the one that you see, that was in a much worse condition than it is now. It was badly reproduced, and it was completely unprofessional, not only in technical terms, but you could see it on the flip side, there was no address, no name, and most unprofessional, no bank account. And I had to decide, can I use this photo, which cannot be reproduced properly for a magazine, for an art magazine, or not? First I thought I cannot do this for technical standards, but then I thought I have to do it because it's one of the most intelligent photos that ever have been made on the Documenta, and it's Documenta 2 in 1959. And although it was in a bad state, I included it because I was fascinated by the contrast it gave to the viewer, the contrast between two different German traditions. The one tradition exemplified by Kandinsky in Germany in the 19th and the early 20th century, a country for immigrants to come to, like Kandinsky did, and study there and work there. Liberal and open-minded, and the other side of Germany represented by two young students belonging to a student corporation, which in the beginning of the 19th century were very liberal as well, but in the middle of the 20th century had been mostly supporters of National Socialism in the university. So, nearly 20 years after National Socialism and the Third Reich was destroyed, somebody had seen this contrast at the moment and had made a photograph of it. And I thought this must have been a very intelligent person, and so I wrote a small eloge to the unknown photographer. And it appeared in 1982, shortly before the Documenta 7 was to be opened, and for the Documenta 7, Hans was in Germany to prepare his contribution to the Documenta 7 1982, and he visited me in Cologne in the office of the art magazine, and I gave him one of the copies of this magazine. And 2 days afterwards, he phoned me and said, "I'm the unknown photographer. So you may know him for years and always be surprised with his work and his person." And that's what I try to focus on this evening. I claim the merit to have convinced him that this is his first work as an artist. It took me some years to convince you, but as you have seen in the exhibition, now it's the beginning of his oeuvre. And I always thought that all that he did later on was already as a nucleus in this photography and this series of photography. What I never managed to convince you of was to also show the paintings that you did in Kassel when you were a student, when you made these photographs. Paintings that you made in the class of Fritz Winter, who was a very prominent and important German post-war painter, belonging to the degenerate artists during the Third Reich. Why do you never exhibit the works that you painted in your student days?
For young artists, when they are trying to come into their own, they do not want to be recognized by what I knew was an adaptation of works that I had seen in Paris and in German galleries, Taschisme, Arlin, Formel, and etc., etc. I was a follower, and I did not want to exhibit those, and indeed they were derivative, and also in retrospect I don't see why, other than for anecdotal reasons, that I'm like every other art student following the examples. I did not add anything that I could be proud of.
I'm not sure, because I saw them, maybe beside Linda, one of the very few persons to know your early work. I found it very convincing, and I think it's interesting for the public as well to see from where you really started, and when you see what fuss is made about the student works of Gerhard Richter at the moment, and people doing research on finding the pieces and finding out from where he started, there's a certain legitimacy in looking at the start before the work starts.
Well, it may have biological interest, but beyond that...
I agree with you in so far as you, after you saw this documenta too and worked there as a student and you made these photographs, you left painting and switched to different and new technologies. And one of the examples is this one, called Les Couloirs de Marine Bat, which refers to a film by Honoré's name. Don't know the English title, maybe The Floors, the Isles, or Last Year at Marine Bat. And this was in 1962, 3 years after the photograph from the documenta. And at the same time, you made a piece in the same material, more or less, that's called Bataille der Reichen Fels, and that referred to Alain Robbe-Grillet. And this sounds as if after the German Academy in Kassel, there was kind of a French connection that influenced you when you went to Paris. How did you come to use this material? What did inspire you to use this new material instead of painting?
Well, in the early 1960s, I started working with reflective materials. So if you look at the physics of this little thing, on the bottom is a highly polished steel plate. Above it, a translucent piece of plexiglass with a pattern of a regular pattern of holes that are drilled into it, which are then reflected in the steel plate in the mirror, so to speak, underneath, so that it is mirroring itself, this object, but also its environment, and it changes continuously depending on the angle from which you view it. So it is not a stable object. In certain ways, visually, it doesn't have a permanent substance. It's always in flux, even though it is an object that can be taken in the hand and smashed against the wall if you don't like it.
Because we, a couple of years ago, there was a research group that was concentrating on the fate of the early non-Garbo pieces who have been done in plastics and new materials as well, and they deteriorate dramatically. So you don't regard any of them as the original that has to survive, but it can be done again. What will happen in 50 years if it deteriorates? Do you just give it?
It's important that they look and have the effect that they had as I intended it at the time of their making. Otherwise, it's just a relic that you may perhaps trade it for a lot of money because it's the original, but it doesn't have the qualities that I was interested in.
And the effect was that there was an interaction between the visitor and the piece of art, because the visitor or the visitors change the climate of the room and give it a different temperature, and so the water reacts within the condensation cone. That was the thing that you were aiming for.
The interaction was much more dramatic, of course, with what was looked at before, with the mirror. In effect, unless the temperature of the room in which this cube is displayed really arises due to a great number of people flocking into this room, it is not affected by the visitor per se, but it is depending on the climactic conditions, the climate, literally speaking, of the area of display, the kind of light, the direction of the light, whether there are air drafts, and that is very good for it, that affects its appearance, or rather, that affects the degree of evaporation of the water and its condensation on the inside walls. And so if one wall is fanned, let's say, by natural means, the difference of temperature between inside and outside is bigger, and therefore there is more condensation.
That is about the time when you were aiming to create what you called real-time systems. Pieces of art that react to the situation in which they are exhibited. Do you see any connection with what Ben Graham later on defined as a closed circuit situation? Was it the same spirit, or is it something completely different?
Well, it's, I could perhaps more say that this is, to use a technical theoretical term, an open system, and a number of works in which I included and responded to social conditions are also open systems, with all the consequences that they may have.
One could say that for the condensation cube, you were focused on the context of the exhibition space. The physical context of the exhibition space and the reaction or interaction between visitor temperature and the water in the condensation cube. In this piece, which is one of my favorites, there's a new aspect in it. It's a process that you start for the time of the exhibition running. And afterwards the piece, what happens to the glass when the exhibition's over?
It's over.
It's over. We don't sell it for the garden of any collectors. So there is a step from context and reaction to process, which at the time also had followers in your generation and was called process art. And it seems like at this time you are finding your way through and in your generation. And the next step to develop a specific oeuvre is that you include technology. And I think one of the first pieces, if not the first pieces, is this one that's shown here, the narrow white flow, in which you include electricity and a way to keep this in motion for the time of the exhibition. What was the influence or the importance of Zero for this development? Because we always see you on the background of American art history, but I think that a couple of years in Germany were important as well for the development of this kind of work. Is it plausible that Zero and especially Otto Fiene have to be regarded as kind of role models for this way you choose at the time?
Well, we could have mentioned them already as a source of inspiration for the early mirror, the reflective works. The pattern of holes that I drilled obviously had similarities to the patterns of the non-compositional patterns of, on the one hand, artists from the Zero group, but also of the Parisian group de recherche d'art visuel. I knew them, I was friends with some of them, and Otto Fiene was indeed somebody who was very helpful in getting opening doors for me. My own sense of it is that the condensation cube, and perhaps also this one, while coming out of the orbit of Zero Group de Recherche d'Art Visuel, type thinking, went already somewhere else.
Were you ever, did you ever think about joining the Zero Group? Was group identity something you were interested in at the time, or did you always try to keep for yourself?
There were a number of occasions when I participated in Zero exhibitions.
But there was no group identity that you had to join?
No.
It was just a group organizing exhibitions, working with the same materials? And one of the next pieces that are interesting also in this exhibition is News that you started in 1969. And you could say that after you developed real-time systems with the pieces before, this looks like kind of a real-world system. You just get what is happening outside the museum inside the museum. And what strikes me most about this work of 1969 is that you go to a kind of zero point of artistic creativity. You can't go any further without giving up any artistic acclaim. In contrast to the myth of the modern artist, who is an everlasting fountain of creativity, of handcraft, or an exemplary figure like Picasso, who was very famous at the time. Did you go to the border voluntarily? What did you expect there? I mean, it's some kind of point of no return if you give away your artistic creativity to just install the machines for information coming in that are not yours.
Well, I think it has to do with the general social and political climate of the late 60s. My generation and also the younger generation was affected a great deal by political events. And those who were living in the US, primarily by the Vietnam War. And my thinking in terms of systems, which started in the mid-60s, led me eventually to the realization that there are not only biological systems, like the grass growing, to give an example, or physical systems with the flowing of a piece of fabric or the condensation, but that the world is also in our own personal existence is determined a great deal by social conditions and the systems terminology at the time, and so I called it a social system. And it became clear to me that the world in which I was functioning as an artist, not only internally was a social system, but it was connected to the rest of the world, I mean, to politics, to society, and so forth. And that was rarely, if ever, acknowledged. And to break out of this fake world of a holy space named art and make it clear that the rest of the world is also there and, in effect, is also determining what is happening in the art world, I so metaphorically broke down the wall by introducing the world at large in terms of its producing itself or its treatment through the press, through the media, and bringing that into the gallery, thereby denying that the gallery is a world apart.
Mm-hmm. 1 year later, you did one of the classical artistic tasks and created a monument. That's what artists did for centuries. It's, by the way, the first work that Hans Hake did in Spain in 1970, and called the Monument for Monument of Beach Pollution. Was this the first ecological project you made, or was it after you thematize the Rhine water in Krefeld?
No, this is probably the first. Yeah.
This one is the first.
Yeah, yeah.
Has it also some kind of subtext in a kind of parody of land art, or was it just an innocent monument?
I don't think it was connected with land art, although one could make such an argument. No, it's in 1970 my family spent a few weeks in Carboneras. We went there because there was a Parisian artist colony and I had friends there, and I saw the garbage on the beach. Not that they were, that this garbage was imported from Paris by the Parisian art. Well, it was what the sea had brought in, and so I thought, well, make something out of it. And so I made a monument.
You just left it there?
And I just left it. I don't know what happened later.
Yeah.
It probably got dispersed. And,
got garbage again.
garbage to garbage.
And then comes a decisive work in your career, which could have cost you your career, which was called Manhattan Real Estate. Most of you know the story that this was planned to be included in your first solo exhibition in the Guggenheim. You were still a very young artist. It would have been a career started to be at the Guggenheim in a solo exhibition at this date. And in the end, the exhibition was cancelled because of this project that you want to include on the real estate relations in New York City. And so after real time systems that you developed and made it a trademark of your oeuvre, and after the real world system that you included with news, you had the first real censorship. Not the last, but the real first censorship. Did you expect this harsh reaction to this project, leading to the cancelling of the exhibition and to the dismission of the curator responsible, Edward Frey?
Of course not. I was naive, one could say.
Really?
Yeah, well, I could not imagine that a prominent museum would that invites an artist to have an exhibition tell the artist, you cannot show this.
You saw the dynamite in the facts, but you did not expect the reaction of it.
I thought, well, there may be some discussions and so forth, but in effect, there's a photograph in the exhibition here. I had planted in the Guggenheim, in preparation for the exhibition, beans that were to grow from the second round to the third round. So I believe in retrospect one can use this as evidence that I was believing that this show would take place.
And in some kind of way it had taken place because of the beans growing.
Oh yeah, they probably would have been. That would not have caused any problems.
No. For us in Germany, it was difficult to understand what the political dynamite was in this project, because you just gave it a kind of a conceptual art aesthetics in a kind of investigation, the artist as an investigator, and you never pointed out, as any journalist would have done, like me, you did not make a headline just to focus the attention on the scandal that is behind this very sober documentation. But the New Yorker public would have immediately understood it, or would it have been to explain to them as well?
Well, as is the case with a good number of my works, they are site-specific, and the visitors, the audience, for the original presentation of the work, as is also true for the new work that I produced here for this exhibition, the Madrid audience, I assume, immediately understands what I'm talking about. And in New York, real estate has always, as long as I've lived there, been a topic that everybody relates to.
Then comes the next project, and this is a project that is very important to me. It's the first time that I saw your name connected with an exhibition in 1974, when I was 24 years. There was an exhibition in Cologne that had the title Art Remains Art, which is more or less the most conservative slogan you can find for art history, and which of course is rubbish.
Who said it?
Yeah, it's rubbish just the same. That was before sociology was invented, so he had no chance to understand it. He should have known better. It's easy to point out that what is conceived as art as a certain period is changed by the next generation, and other things that have not been conceived as art or are established as art. So this was a more or less provocative slogan to say that art remains art, and I think it was provocation and a goodwill movement to say it in favor of contemporary art. That was, I think, the ambition that this slogan had. And you exemplified this slogan, and Comte your content, you wie sagt man, widerlegen.
Proved it wrong.
Yeah, you proved it wrong, thank you. And the story is that it starts with a piece that is rather famous by Edouard Manet, Still Life with Asparagus. And you put it into the context of the painter, the first collector, and all the collectors and heirs that followed. And for a non-German public, it's not so easy to understand that you focused on the fact that this was a kind of a donation given to the museum in Cologne. And one of the points were that most of the owners of this piece during the history have been Jews, and that the donator, the chief of the donation, the donators group, was Hermann Josef Abs, who was president of the Deutsche Bank at the moment, and who can be regarded in hindsight as one of the war criminals of the Third Reich, but nevertheless had a German after-war career that brought him to high positions. And this was your second experience with censorship, because this was banned from the exhibition. And that arose my interest, that something was banned. I was 24, I was a young artist then, but most of all I was socialized with the student revolution and we were sensitive for what was happening. Daniel Buren made a very impressive act by having your work photocopied and presented as his own work, which was censored as well. Marcel Duchamp made a very collegial gesture as well. Brothas. So what did I say? Duchamp comes later. Marcel Brothas did a very generous gesture as well. Originally, he had exposed one palm tree, and in protest against the censorship, he exhibited two palm trees. So this was the first time that I was drawn into your oeuvre. But it was difficult to understand why this had been censored to us, because every information that you gave about UPS was public information. How did you experience this? How was this made into a scandal?
Well, actually, the role UPS played as a high functionary of the Deutsche Bank during the Nazi period was not well known or was not talked about. And in effect, I learned about it through a book that I found in the public library or in the university library in Bonn. A book written by a West German writer, but it was published in East Germany. And there it was possible to attack people that were in influential positions in West Germany. One need to also remember that Hermann Josef Abs, the head of the Deutsche Bank, was closely related to Konrad Adenauer, who was the chancellor of West Germany. So there was a political network that was very powerful. And therefore, probably, one didn't speak and write about some shady aspects of this career.
What astonished me at the time was that only by the massive censorship they made it a scandal. I think otherwise nobody would have looked close to what you found out. And this was more or less against what they wanted to do.
Actually, what might also be worthwhile noticing is that this painting and the actual ceremony of handing this painting over to the museum at the occasion of its 150th anniversary got several pages in the celebratory brochure that attracted my attention. I didn't know anything about it before.
After real-time systems, after the process pieces with the growing grass, after the real-world pieces, this was kind of a historical investigation, social historical investigation. And the second one that interested me and that I was connected with focused on a famous German and international art collector, Peter Ludwig, under the title of the Chocolate Master. This gave you kind of some sociological credit even amongst sociologists. I remember that Howard Becker edited a book with you on framing and being framed. He regarded you as a colleague working in a different field but to the same aims. This series of pictures that are seen and can be seen in the exhibition focuses on this collector and does research on his influence on the art market. And what is most striking to me in retrospect is that how you change languages to deal with this topic. For the Manet piece, you choose a very neutral, sober, let's say, concept art layout. For this one, you changed completely the layout. What did inspire you to do this?
Well, for the Manet panels, and here in the collection presentation at the moment, there's a companion piece. I did also work on the provenance of a Seurat painting. For those, the form I chose was that of the so-called tombstone, which was an American journalistic term for advertisements that in those days were published in newspapers, advertisements of a new emission of stocks for a company. I tried to mimic that, whereas for the work on Peter Ludwig's empire and empire building, I adopted what one could perhaps consider being derived from the example of pop art. And in effect, Peter Ludwig was a major collector of pop art. That's how he made himself a name originally. And these are the packages of the chocolates that he produced in various different brands and also in different factories and even countries. But then on top, these are all diptychs, seven diptychs. There's the portrait photograph of Peter Ludwig juxtaposed with photographs of the workers in his chocolate factory in Aachen.
There's a lot of fuss made by Gerhard Richter changing his style every 5 minutes. When I see at your work, you're changing languages, not every five minutes, but in relation to the topic. But there's always a kind of subtext of parody in it. Parody of pop art here, parody of the advertisement that you just told about in the Manet series. But did you never experience a moment when you have to think about if you lose your artistic identity, if you just go on in parodies of your topics and of artistic languages?
I never thought of it.
You never thought about it? The next piece that I want to talk about is the oil painting from 1982, which confronts a demonstration in Germany against the at the time reigning the president of the American of the United States, Ronald Reagan. And what I'm that was shown at the Documenta in 1982. And what I'm interested in is the question: why did you dedicate this to Marcel Grotius? What does this dedication mean in this context?
Well, there are two reasons. One, I was very, very impressed by an exhibition that I saw of his at the Düsseldorf Kunsthalle on the Eagles. This was an exhibition of works from various collections in which the Eagle major figure was for me a mind-blowing exhibition. And the other reason was he had chosen stanchions with a red velvet rope in one of his works, in one of his installations. So in effect I had adopted an element of his work, and I thought it was only fair in a situation like this also to pay my tribute to him.
The element that inspires awe in front of art and the president. Is this the first painting that you did after you quit painting?
Yes.
Did you enjoy painting?
Yeah, it was fun to try something that I never learned, because I never learned doing portrait paintings.
You were trained as abstract painter.
Yeah, I was a student in Kassel, and abstract art was the dominant approach to things.
So this was a new try to make socialist realism.
Yeah, and so I discovered that if you don't want to do a Mona Lisa, to do a figurative portrait from photographs is you can get by.
Okay. The next dedication that you did is this one, and this is now the time for Marcel Duchamp. In advance of the broken RM, I wondered if this is one work or if this two works. I always thought that the Art and Argent, Art et Argent, Arthur des Etages, was a work of its own, but it belongs to the broken piece that we see here. Is it two works or is it one work?
It's one work.
It's one work,
yeah.
It belongs together.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a parody, again, a parody of a sign that normally says Au Égard, c'est tous les étages. And what struck me about this piece is that it makes each museum instantly a real-time economic system, visible as an economic time, a real-time economic system. When did you first hear of Duchamp? Duchamp was relatively lately discovered in Germany.
Probably I became vaguely familiar with him and his role in the early 60s when I was in the United States, and I in fact saw him in person and took photographs of him when he gave a talk at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I don't tell you everything.
Yeah, no,
that's a long time.
That's why we're here.
And of course, he was living in New York, and the New York art world was somewhat familiar with him, and he had inspired people like Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns and others of that generation. And then coming back to Germany, I saw a book that had just been published by Dumont on Marcel Duchamp by a French author. I can't think of his name. Yeah, Lebel. And I got this, and that's how I became more familiar with the work of Duchamp.
You first saw the person, and then you studied his work. And then we switch to the last chapter of our talk, which is concerned with projects in the public sphere. This is a project in Graz, in the Austrian town of Graz, and this is the situation that is the normal situation in the city with this large column with Mary, St. Mary on the top. And this column was used by the National Socialists when they occupied Austria to be changed into a kind of pillar with the inscription "Und ihr habt doch gesiegt," which means more or less "and you were victorious after all." This is a photograph from 1938, and it's a celebration of National Socialist power expanding to the neighboring countries, Austria first. And you cited this piece when you were invited to Graz with the same slogan, "and you were victorious after all." Why did you use this slogan for this piece?
Well, I mimicked the Nazi celebration, but I added a comment on the bottom. You see it in the black field with Fraktur letter typeface, listing the vanquished, the ones who lost, and it was sort of a bookkeeping listing, and the numbers of soldiers killed in the war, the ones who died in prison, the Jews who did not survive the victory, sort of a balance of what this victory that was celebrated left to the Austrians in Graz.
And did you, again the question, did you expect this massive reaction that somebody tried to burn your version?
No, I didn't. And, I believe no one expected that in the middle of the night somebody came with a firebomb and blow it up, and thereby also melting the statue of the Virgin Mary. She did not survive.
We skip these two and go to the next project in Venice, which was at the German Pavilion. A German Pavilion, which is was a difficult political question at the time, because when you were invited, it was still debatable to if this pavilion that belonged to the German Federal Republic should not be opened to artists from the former GDR as well, to give them some kind of rehabilitation. And Klaus Busmann, who was the curator responsible, chose another way to make this exhibition. He chose you as somebody who left Germany, and he chose Nam June Paik as somebody who came to Germany from Korea. And you focused on the as well on the history of this building and the visits that had been paid by the Nazi prominent figure Adolf Hitler, and you focused as well on the reunification of Germany on the spot, with a piece that was very impressive by just destroying the floor and writing Germania on the back of the building, which is kind of a vandalistic intervention, and was very impressive in a visual way, but also an acoustic experience. Did you expect that too?
I was not thinking of it. So I didn't know what would happen in terms of acoustics, I only had an idea what it would look like. But in effect, when visitors tried to walk over these broken plates, every time there was a cracking sound, and it was almost as if guns were going off. And that certainly was something that helped.
You approached it visually and it turned out acoustically.
Yes.
It was kind of a destroyed stage for an irritated public.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. More than helped, it made it a very dense
yes.
situation. And if we regard the museum as a public space too, which I do, this is one of the projects that occupied you on several locations. This one in Rotterdam, but you did it as well in the Victoria and Albert Museum in the Serpentine Gallery. This is in Rotterdam, where you were invited to work with a collection of the museum by Chris Dacol, I think, in the Bonnets from Barney. I wonder why curators invite artists to do their job.
It doesn't happen frequently. Most curators would like to retain control. And that's natural. I don't hold that against them. And it was a tradition for a number of years in Rotterdam to invite artists of various stripes to rehang parts of the collection. And one could argue that this is an interesting way to introduce the public to what is in storage and sometimes on view from a very different angle than curators would normally do. Because in case of doubt, they do it art historically.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a staging, as my predecessors did, and as I try to do it.
And you used the exhibition rooms as well as the depot in English?
Well, in effect, what you see here on the wall is, and this is the upstairs, as I call it, I went through the storage of the museum, as I did it at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London later on, because I wanted to get a sense of what they have, and for one, also wanted to see the works that are not normally on exhibition. And the storage places of museums are absolutely fascinating, because there, everything, irrespective of art historical significance, of monetary value, or other reasoning, hangs tightly together, because a space needs to be saved.
Without context.
Without context, through periods and so forth. And I thought this is something that is worth exhibiting. And I rebuilt the storage upstairs, namely in the official exhibition space. And there, as you see on the photograph, I kind of mimicked what the museum is actually working with.
Were you conscious of, I mean, there's a tradition for this, a short tradition as far as I can see. Andy Warhol was the first artist to be invited to do this kind of job in America. Were you conscious of this, of his example?
I don't even know that he did.
No,
yeah.
I don't tell you everything as well. No, it was right in the icebox, and I think it was in the early 70s that he was invited to. And what struck me about this project is that when you see this work done by an artist, you are more aware than when it's done by a curator then it's kind of generating meaning, generating context, in this case by contrast. And the last piece we talk about, this was in Münster, 1997, where you built a hidden carousel next to a historical monument. There's the monumental context again. And as far as I can see, the idea was to relate to, and this is a monument dedicated to a war, and as I understood the idea, was the idea to relate to the idea of the eternal return of history in a circular form. And all you could see was through the gaps between the boards, and you saw a normal children's carousel. I took this as one example, and I wonder if it was correct for a thesis that I developed in 1997 when I was commissioned to write the catalogue essay. This was the third sculpture project in Münster for me, and my impression was that this sculpture project in Münster, which was had many merits, was beginning to become a kind of festival, and had its aspects like of a biennial or like a circus of artists traveling all around the world, doing their site-specific pieces all over the world. Some of them all the same all over the world, some of them different all over the world. Was this a kind of comment to this kind of circus as well, or is that my interpretation of it?
That's my interpretation.
Okay, I stick to it. Ladies and gentlemen, we are open for your questions. Is anybody going around with a microphone, or do we manage it? Are there questions? Yes, please. Du musst dir das Ding aufsetzen, damit du das verstehst. Do you ask in English or in Spanish?
Spanish.
Spanish.
Hablo español, no otro idioma. Tendréis que traducir. Es una pregunta para Hans. ¿Tú no piensas que la reacción que tuvo en Austria tu obra era previsible? Porque siempre cuando se hace una provocación de ese tipo es normal, ¿no?, que pasen ese tipo de cosas, aunque nos pueda extrañar. ¿Lo preveías aquello?
No, I did not expect that firebombs would go off if I remind people of the past in that city. And in effect, I believe also it was shocking to the Graz public. It turned out that the bomb was thrown by a young neo-Nazi who had been inspired by an older Nazi survivor and a continued follower of the Nazi Party. And for whatever it's worth, the two were among the public that watched the annual torch procession that took place in Austria in November. At that time, and maybe still today, to commemorate the Kristallnacht, the night when Jewish shops were had the windows smashed by the Nazis, and these two men were watching it, and a taxi driver who had witnessed the firebombing, who had given a description and somehow triggered the police to go after them. They were caught, and they went. There was a trial, and they went to prison.
Any more questions, please? Critic is welcome too. Yes, please.
Well, I would like to propose a work of art, which is my next question. Is art death? And of course, you can collaborate and be co-author of my work of art, if you want. Otherwise, I will be the only one, and maybe the last one, because if you consider that my question is a work of art, and art is death, so this is the last one, and will be in the books of history of art in a very prominent position. So it's a good opportunity for you for the artist, Mr. Hacke, to collaborate with me if he wants.
I believe neither I nor anyone else can determine what is art. And I also don't believe that you can, because this what one calls art is in effect a social agreement. That is to say, it takes a number of people who are recognized, for better or worse, as experts, or as for one reason or another are being considered to know something and to determine such issues of philosophical and nature. If they determine something to be art, and they have enough followers to share that opinion, then something becomes art. You know that Marcel Duchamp, for the longest time by the general public, was not considered to be an artist. And in effect, a very prominent American art historian, Clement Greenberg, who's no longer with us, very, very prominent and very powerful. He determined a great deal of what museums in the US collected. He had a tremendous effect on the art market. He thought that Duchamp was not really worth mentioning. For him, there was nobody between Picasso and the abstract expressionists whom he was promoting. And for a while, this is the example, people were following his word. And it was the minimal artists and conceptual artists who were the rebellion against this attitude. So the story of death is something that is decided collectively.
So if there are no more, on the back, up there.
I have one question. It's, I still haven't seen your exposition here in Madrid, but it's about real estate and speculation. I mean, you're a very political artist, living in Europe, you're a German, touching quite controversial themes in Europe. And I think now in Europe here is a very, very interesting situation when you see in Greece, Spain, what you have seen here 2 years ago, it's gone to speculation. We have another situation, political situation in Spain. We have another situation in Europe. When I would give you, I don't know, 100,000 euros and give you 3 months to do something about Europe, what would you do? What an interesting in Europe right now for you?
I don't quite know how to answer that question. Each country and each continent today has its own problems, and of course they are interrelated. So the politics are no longer purely national politics. But how I would invest €1,000 at the moment, I'm at a loss to answer.
Yes, over there.
Hola. Hi. In some way, you started something like a more traditional artist, and you have became something like political. And how did you feel that evolution? Is that in some way you became more political aware as you grew up, or in some way just politics turned to be more interesting during your life and in that times? I don't know if I explained.
Already when I was a high school student, I read the newspaper, and I read a magazine that still exists today that you can buy at a newsstand at the Paseo del Prado, the Der Spiegel. And to some degree, I must say, it gave me a political education and also introduced me particularly to some of the history of Germany. But it was only in the latter part of the 60s that I came around to include these issues in my own work as an artist. But as I perhaps alluded to earlier, I'm part of that generation that was politicized in the second half of the 60s. In Europe, it was the 68 generation, which of course also had its equivalents in the US, in Berkeley, at Columbia University, and, Kent State, and so forth. But there were differences. In Europe, it was more a social, political, and cultural revolution. It was starting in Paris and spread, and also in Berlin, and spreading across the continent, whereas in the US, it was primarily, I believe, triggered by the Vietnam War, as I've said earlier, but also by the racial conflicts of the country. And given that I was interested in the interaction of elements, at the time I used the word systems, physical and biological, at some point, being part of that generation and reacting to what was happening in the world, I had the feeling, well, this is also a system, and it would be, in fact, cowardice or looking away from something that affected all of us at the time. And literally, it affected in the States almost every family that had somebody who was sent to Vietnam. The wars of the that the U.S. got engaged in, like in Iraq, for instance, didn't have the same effect because this, by now it's a professional army. It doesn't affect the population anymore. But at that time, everybody was involved. And that I was part of that world. Fortunately, none of my family members was sent to Vietnam. So that was not a personal issue, but I knew so many people, and I was teaching in an art school in New York, and a good number of my students at the time were trying to evade the draft. There was one way either to immigrate to Canada and not being readmitted to the country for many, many, many years, and another one to get a deferment, as it was called, by being a student in the university. So I had a number of students who signed up in an art school in order to avoid being sent to Vietnam. And that is pretty close to home.
Si uno entra en internet y teclea allí una web en Giglio, puede ver un barco que está hundido en Costa Concordia. Eso da casi para hacer una obra de arte, pienso yo. El mundo parece ser que va en un barco a la deriva, que va sin rumbo. De hecho, lo demuestran los científicos, ya tienen los datos de que vamos mal. Entonces la pregunta es, ¿hasta qué punto el arte puede abrir las conciencias para digamos, enderezar el rumbo de ese barco?
Well, I think it would be asking too much of art to become the captain of a ship. I would rather say that what is exhibited in museums, what galleries show, that is to say, more precisely, where artworks are seen by a public, that has an opportunity, not for sure though, in each case, but there is a chance that it enters the public discourse as millions of other elements enter the what people directly or indirectly are responding to, the so-called zeitgeist, the public consensus that is built out of these myriads of elements, and that is where art could play a little role. It's like I often use this image. It is like pieces in a mosaic. If a few more pieces of a particular color are introduced into this mosaic, which is the general consensus of a society, then it shifts more to looking in this fashion rather than another way. So one should be modest about it, but not to believe that it has no effect at all.
First of all, thank you. My question is, well, if you can a bit elaborate about the process of your works, because in a way they are very much responding always to a context, and specifically to a context on the site. And I was wondering, how does the idea evolve from? Is it from the invitation, from a dialogue? Is it from something you would like to do, and then comes the institution or the context that allows it? Or yeah, if you can elaborate on that aspect of how the project comes into being, in a way.
Varies a great deal, as you correctly say. It is often related to the context in which a new work would be presented to the public. But how I then focus on something that eventually is the work, that is a process that there's no system to it. It's like when you daydream and you respond to experiences that you had during the day or a week before or maybe even a year ago, how that finally becomes a focused approach to something is something that maybe somebody who knows more about psychology than I do can explain, but I can't.
There was a question over here.
Hi. My question is, to what extent do you hold all artists responsible as far as studying on some formal level history and art history, politics, museology, some of the many themes that we see in your work? I mean, do you think contemporary artists today, art can still be created outside of these spheres? Can any art be made without reference to any such themes as we've seen them in your work?
I always shy away from being prescriptive, to tell people what they should do. And it would, in fact, be presumptuous for me to claim that I know best. So I'd rather encourage, as I did with my students, I taught for 35 years, to learn how to think on their own and make their own decisions and find their own way.
Cuando te interesa mostrarnos las relaciones ocultas que hay entre lo que pueden ser las propiedades en Nueva York y sus dueños y un cuadro y sus dueños, también me gustaría saber si el formato expositivo es el último lugar donde muestras esa información, o si te interesa distribuirla por otros canales que no sean el formato expositivo. Si te interesa, si de alguna manera mueves también esa información para que llegue a otros niveles que no sea solo el ámbito artístico.
Well, occasionally I, not only I myself, but many other artists, are invited to produce something in the public arena. So the example that you saw of a work in Graz, while it was done under the auspices of an arts festival, it was done in where the people who live in Graz and go shopping and take the streetcar or sit on a bench where they are exposed to it and in effect respond to it as these two neo-Nazis did. And in one of the photographs that I got, I was not present at the time in Graz, shows that there was a large group of people the next day to look at the disaster that had happened the night before. I did a number of other works in a non-art context. It doesn't happen often that you're offered the opportunity to do that. So it's not quite a matter of choice. It is what you can work with, what opportunities you are given.
There's a question over there, but two, okay.
Uno de los procedimientos que utilizados por ti durante tu carrera y que no se ha mencionado en la relación que hemos visto es la encuesta. Hay una famosa encuesta que se hizo en el MoMA preguntando a los visitantes sobre su opinión respecto a la participación de los Rockefeller en la guerra de Vietnam. Has hecho otras encuestas durante tu carrera y en esta ocasión, en la exposición realizada para el Reina Sofía en Castillos en el Aire, vuelves a hacer una encuesta. Una encuesta donde propones al público que se retrate tanto demográficamente, su edad, estatus laboral, vivienda y también qué opine sobre cuestiones de carácter político, que dé su opinión. En primer lugar, quería que si podías elaborar más sobre por qué, digamos, invitar o interpelar al público dentro de una exposición a que se retrate o que opine o que participe o que dé su opinión en estos términos de encuesta o de votación que parece reflejar tanto las votaciones democráticas como el modo en que burocráticamente tenemos que retratarnos cuando uno va a entrar a un país extranjero, por ejemplo. O sea, ¿cuál es el objeto y la lógica de estas encuestas? Y también, por otro lado, ver si desde entonces, creo que fue en el año 71, cuando hiciste aquella encuesta del MoMA, hasta hoy, lo que puede haberse perdido es el interpelar al público sobre el propio formato expositivo o sobre la propia institución. Entonces, la encuesta que ahora nos propones, utilizas el museo como plataforma para encuestar al público, pero no la encuesta sobre el propio museo o sobre la propia función del arte. No sé, son las dos preguntas, una sobre el formato encuesta en sí mismo, cuál es su sentido dentro de tu trabajo, y el segundo, si puedes observar un desplazamiento en el uso de tales encuestas.
The first poll that you mentioned from 1970 at the Museum of Modern Art was a very pointed question, and it had something to do with the powers that are behind the museum and also the political situation at the time. After that, I did a number of polls, not only with one question, but with 20 questions. 10 of them usually demographic questions and 10 with inquiring about the visitors' opinions on then current political issues. I did such a poll at Documenta in 1972. I did a few in the US and commercial galleries. And here, for the first time, I was able to do something that I had already designed as an idea in 1970 in New York, namely to have it computer processed, and that the results with a short delay would be presented in the exhibition. I was attracted to polling the visitors of art spaces, museums, commercial galleries, and other places, because I was intrigued to have the visitors participate in producing a self-portrait, and to make them understand who they are in the group to which they belong, and how that group then, in effect, constitutes the public of a museum, and for that matter also my public. I think it is useful to know where one is situated, who one's peers are, and what are the differences that one has. And this is, in a minor way, part of what I think is political education.
There's a question over there. At the right side.
Bueno, en primer lugar quería agradecer a Hans este último trabajo que ha dedicado a nuestro barrio, el Sánchez de Vallecas. Yo soy uno de los colonos o habitantes que llevamos viviendo en aquel barrio desde hace 4 o 5 años, y a su vez, desde que se empezó a poblar, formamos un grupo de arte vecinal que trabaja en proyectos relacionados con todos los intereses que tienen los vecinos del barrio. Generalmente el tema de malos olores o proveniente de la incineradora de Valdemín Gómez y todo eso. Bueno, en concreto la pregunta es, nosotros trabajamos en este ámbito local y desarrollamos proyectos de ámbito local. ¿Cómo considera Hans la proyección que pueda tener este tipo de acciones locales a nivel global? Gracias.
Well, I'm glad that in this audience there is somebody who is actually coming from the neighborhood that I got fascinated by. I was out there today again and took more photographs. And, I don't know how what to, I do not want to recommend anything that would be presumptuous. I'm glad that as you say, there is a group of people who live there who want to change things that are not quite the way they should be. I've heard about the incinerator and the smells that come from the incinerator, but every time I'm out there, I'm struck by the fact that, I mean, I was out there for 2 or 3 hours today, and I only saw 10 people, not more, probably even less. And still with one bakery, or maybe it's not a bakery anymore, not a single shop. One has to cross the Gran Via in order to have a beer. It is, in certain ways, a sad neighborhood, although I understand that the people who are living there probably are glad that they found this place and that some instances it is also affordable. But what you, should be done is a political issue, and I would assume that it would help a great deal if, I shouldn't put it that way, it would be great if the the people who live there are organized, maybe they are, and they have an impact on the politics that govern their environment. And maybe you can say, yes, there is this thing, and we're getting things done.
No more critique, so I thank you for coming and wish you a good evening.